are some of the common key elements that you have to use them to form the foundation of a sustainable customer acquisition program for D2C?
You know, there's product market fit. There's also product market channel fit. That's something you have to continually test, verify, validate, rinse and repeat.
Given all the new complexities today, how do you know you have product market fit? How do you go about finding it?
Growth is all about learning. And it boils down to having an experiments matrix where everything you do, every campaign, every touch point is an experiment, from a Facebook ad to your entire pricing strategy.
Welcome to Growth Talks, where we dive deep into the world of growth and marketing with industry leaders. I'm Christina Rubino, the general manager of Offline at Right Side Up. Today, I am so excited to chat with Manveer Sodia, the SVP of marketing at Whisker, the brand behind the innovative products, including Litter Robot, Feeder Robot, and Litter Box. Prior to Whisker, Manveer was VP of Growth Marketing at Aura, where he oversaw teams in D2C commerce, media advertising, product growth, and business intelligence. Before joining Aura, Manveer spent nearly 6 years at the Pill Club, contributing to finding product market fit and scaling the business significantly in its later stages. In this episode, we're going to dive deep into what it takes to build and grow a successful D2C e-commerce company, Manveer's secret weapon for successful marketing, and why there's more to performance marketing than just Meta and Google. So let's get to it. Manveer, thank you so much for joining me. I'm so excited to chat today.
Me too. It's great to be here.
Well, we've known each other for a while, and I think I always come away from discussions learning something when we chat, and I can't wait to get into it. One thing that really interests me is always like looking at the backstory of our superheroes of the episode. But like, you started your career in music and entertainment. You didn't start, I mean, marketing is one of those disciplines that people discover or fall into, but like, you didn't start your career being like, oh no, I'm going to be a growth marketer. I'm going to be a marketer. Like, how did you transition from music and entertainment to transition into marketing?
Yeah, a lot of left turns, and really, like many folks, you know, we're always learning, we're always growing. I think when many of us started down this career path, or found this career path rather, the work, these careers, this type of work didn't really exist as we know it. And it's always changing. And another 5 years from now, 10 years from now, it may look very different yet again. I went to school studying poli-sci and medicine, and had aspirations of becoming a practicing doctor one day. But I pursued my passion in music and had an opportunity to work with some incredible artists. And similar to startups in tech, it's all about building brands and networking and connecting with audiences at the end of the day. And I had that opportunity by taking some left turns, taking chances, and going from building websites in college for fun to building websites for bands to managing bands who were quite successful for their time. But really, it's that transition happened almost by accident, where you're working in music and one day someone says, Facebook is launching for music, and do you want to have two of the first 100 page accounts? And I chased that, and here we are today.
Oh, that's so cool. Facebook has been around for so long, but like, yeah. Also it hasn't. Like, it's right. Just so, it's a funny thing.
And it's always changing. But artists in the mid 2000s were trying to grow on social media. And really, MySpace was, you know, where everyone wanted to be. You remember that?
Totally. Oh, I mean, dude, I was talking with somebody the other day on our team, and I'm like, do you remember when we just publicly ranked our top 8 friends? Like, right.
Oh my
the
gosh.
Chaos of the early 2000s, when none of us knew what to do with the internet, was a special kind of joy.
I think that's where toxicity started in our culture.
It's probably not far off.
Yeah, now we grew up like limiting your friends to like your top 8 and the rest aren't important. It was just crazy how much it did to shape pop culture. And as they were going from college students to high school students to gen pop, they were really looking to expand, and music was where I was at. And I was fortunate enough to get there early and learn about and start building early days social media, eventually moving to paid social and continuing to learn from there.
Yeah. And it's kind of interesting, like you've worked across so many different categories, and I'm just curious, like what the threads are that you see through all of them, but like, you've gone from women's health to you know, a bunch of different stops along the way, but you've gone women's health, you've gone, you know, personal wellness, well-being, fitness, and now to Whisker, which is a totally different, I was going to say beast. It's literally a pet care company. I'm just totally. Like, oh,
yeah,
God.
Yeah, no, it's,
but
totally. I was going to say it's, there are some common threads and there's rhyme behind that reason. It's to me, people who know me hear me say this word all the time. It's about finding blue oceans, creating new markets, creating new categories, and scaling new categories that didn't exist. I think each of the companies I've worked at didn't have a competitor when they started. And even as they grew, there was never really quite a direct competitor that you could label or define or identify. And so I think that's what I enjoy, whether it's expanding women's healthcare access through telemedicine and pharmacy services and making that more available to smart rings and tracking your wellness, not as a pro athlete might or someone who's really into it, but someone who's never really gotten into it before and is just learning for the first time, to pet tech and pet care, where you have a connected ecosystem and you're not just enriching your life as a pet parent, but your pets who you love so much, you're learning something about them that you would have otherwise never heard of. And someone else shared this well. It's almost giving a voice to your pets who don't have a voice when you can see their insights, you know, brought up to you. So it's, yeah, at the end of the day, I thrive, you know, in environments where you're sailing blue oceans.
Yeah. I love that. I hadn't heard that phrase before, and I love that because they're different, but so many of the fundamentals of growth marketing are very translatable. Like when you think about the foundation and creating a solid foundation, and some of the companies that you've gone to already had a foundation in place, right? But like, what are some of the common key elements that you are just like, you have to use them to form the foundation of a sustainable customer acquisition program for D2C?
Absolutely. So, you know, there's product market fit. There's also product market channel fit. And that's something you have to continually test, verify, validate, rinse and repeat. And consumer behavior constantly evolves and changes. You might, things that work 1 year might not work the next. Not everything is repeatable forever. So to get to a sustainable growth mindset, culture, process, I believe you have to always go back to having a common set of principles that guide your team and also the value propositions that you're communicating to your customers, the highest level, not so much here's a feature and here's what it does for you and how it benefits your life, going even higher level to emotional value propositions. Does this product or service inspire trust, credibility? Is it affordable? How does this offer convenience? Being able to map that, track that over time and document and learn what is resonating with your customers. So whether you're testing on Meta or YouTube or TikTok or Snap or Reddit or whatever channel it might be on the digital side, you're constantly trying to test your assumptions. And I mean, I'd say that goes beyond into the offline world as well, which I'm sure you know really well. The value prop is universal, and that's what's great.
Yeah. And it's interesting because one of the things I wanted to ask you is like, what's the through line? Because again, it's like on the face of it, the companies that you've chosen to work at and the work that you've chosen to do has some through lines, but it's, I do think bringing it back to affordability and value are relative concepts, right? If something adds a ton of value to my life, and if it is right for me as a consumer, then I'm going to be willing to pay for it because it's a quality of life thing. And I love that you can boil down and distill marketing to those elements because people are not stupid. One of the things that is more, I mean, honestly, I'd say more challenging than ever almost is how educated the average consumer is about how they're being marketed to. Like there's a reason influencer marketing works so well. there's like this kind of like cut through the crap instinct. And there's a lot of that in what you just said.
Exactly. I mean, and you're right. It's customers are smarter than ever, right? They can see through the BS and they want to get straight to the facts. We're in a culture where companies like RX Bar are out there putting their ingredients on the label. And that's what people care about more when it comes to, you know, trusting a brand. It's what am I getting? Not what are all the bells and whistles? They're just looking for the facts. And we're in a low patience world right now. So making sure that authenticity is there, being straightforward with your audience and your customers, and ultimately, you know, it's connecting with those audiences through your content.
Yeah. And I've been actually chatting with a few marketers about this. And I think just even in, you know, full disclosure to anybody listening, I've known Mombeer for a while now. We've worked together. That's actually a terrifying thought. But one of the things that is one of my favorite things about Mombeer is his authenticity. And it's true. And even just in the conversations that we've had over the years, it's not always easy doing the job that we do. And there are some times where things break or stuff doesn't work the way you want it to. But one thing that I've realized is the more authentic the internal marketing team and the internal organization and the whole, like, you know, I'm not going to go so far and be like corporations are people too, but they're comprised of people. They're comprised of human beings who ultimately, depending on their aims, want to do some good or want to live authentically. And I think that comes out in how you conduct yourself and in, you know, just in briefly getting to know about and of the team at Whisker, like that seems to pervade everything that you guys do. And it comes across in your marketing. You know, your marketing is intelligent and authentic because the people that work there are intelligent and authentic.
It's really, really kind of you. And look, I appreciate that mindset. And, you know, I agree. The culture that you have in a company is so important. And it's hard to recreate that. It takes a lot of hard work of finding people who share your values and ultimately, you know, just see it as, you know, life is too short, right? We're here for a limited time and then who knows what happens next. And so it's important to put your best quality work forward and love what you do. You know, if I'm here because I love pets. I've been a cat person and dog person my whole life. And I know that a lot of folks there are clearly signed up for that same, you know, for that same reason. But beyond that, it's make sure that the work we do and the time we have together is well spent and that we're, like you said, corporations aren't people, you know, where no one's perfect, but we're tribes of folks coming together with a common purpose and common theme. And I think one value that we have that I absolutely stand by and appreciate and love about Whisker is that we want every single person to be redundant. And we mean that in the best way. You know, can we build this company to such a level that it will stand the test of time, regardless of who's there and who's running? And that's all about documenting, building good practices, having those principles in place. So that transcends whatever may happen with people.
I love that. It's, you know, I there's something to be said for when you want to have something around versus when you need to have something around, and building something that stands the test of time is, I think, one of the most rewarding things about what we do. And like, it's so interesting though, because for a while there, creating a D2C brand, and I'm not trying to minimize anybody's work, but creating a D2C brand really felt like, all right, get a sans serif font and a decent website name and invest in Facebook, and then you scale Facebook, and then you scale Instagram, and then you scale Google, and then you write checks and you cash checks. Like, that was the meta of what we do. For a hot minute there. Yeah, for a minute. But it doesn't work anymore, right? Like in today's world, like not least because of all the algorithmic changes over the years. And, you know, we could talk about this a little later, but I'm of the mindset that there are few, if any, growth hacks. It's just, did you get to a channel early enough to like mess some shit up, right? Like, have you taken advantage of the opportunities that are available to you when they're available? But like, given all the new complexities today with performance advertising and marketing, how do you know you have product market fit? How do you go about finding it? And how do you know, right? Not mm-hmm. just inclination, not just testing and results and whatever, but how do you know?
Yeah. Great question. So, you know, I think there's a few dimensions in which to splice this, and there's the customer's journey that's somewhat universal. I like the pirate funnel setup: awareness, acquisition, activation, revenue, referral, retention. The first letter spells out R like a pirate. But, you know, just being able to look through that, the customer journey without lens, and create a matrix view, whatever that might be for your business, whether you're using one of the newer apps out there or something as simple as Google Sheets, just going in and creating marketing moments, campaigns, messages, websites, themes, whatever, but basically testing whatever research you have on your positioning, your brand tone, your personality, your how you want to take your product to market. You need to constantly validate that across all those touch points on the funnel. Mm. I mean, for sure, you know, businesses care about one thing, that's driving revenue, and yeah. being able to do that consistently, reliably. So you're going to have to look at that pirate funnel and now take in your acquisition channels into the mix and see if those messages, if those creatives resonate. And it's about being scrappy as well, especially mm-hmm. in the earlier days. You cannot have endless assumptions and you can't have endless polish on some of this work. It's important to just get things out the gate to learn fast. That's key, right? Like growth is all about learning. And it boils down to having an experiments matrix where everything you do, every campaign, every touch point is an experiment, from a Facebook ad to your entire pricing strategy. And so I guess my point here is there is no easy answer. You're going to have to constantly test. And the big question of when, really, it depends on the business. It depends on the product. But yeah. I think you know it when you're able to recreate that reliably. It's about spinning the flywheel and making sure it's able to continue spinning.
Yeah. And it's funny, you kind of touched on this a little bit, but one of the things that I recently learned about you, and this is the whole, like, we all have our little tricks, right? We all have like our playbook or our things that we do that we're like, oh, I can apply this here. But you take it to another level, my friends. Like, you have created, and to your point, it's in Google Sheets. Like, it's not a mythical document or an expensive subscription or whatever, but you have a growth matrix that you've created over time and refined over time. And I was so impressed by it. And I was like, at some point you need to write a book. I'm not even just saying that to flatter you. Like, I already got you on the show. Like, it's fine. But like, seriously, you need to write some sort of a book, because that is fire. So like, to your point about experimentation, how did you organize this? And like, just tell me a little bit about the way you thought about building that matrix and executing it.
Absolutely. So no, I appreciate that. It's about having a centralized ledger, you know, between growth teams, marketing, product, engineering. Really, it's something that you can put out to the whole company. Now, you'll have a few key stakeholders on it. You need a single owner within the business who manages that process, that program, who has very clear ownership. But then you want multiple teams and groups and people to be able to contribute to it. It's really, you know, like we said, it's not rocket science. It's about being able to document something at scale and repeat it quarterly or annually, but essentially, going back to the topic of the pirate funnel, identify which part of the funnel you want to impact, put a target out there, a threshold for success. Did you hit the target or did you not hit the target based off that test? Was there stat sig or not? What is the next step? You know, nothing is ever one and done. There's always an evolution. There's always multiple iterations that come forward. So you have to align as a team and ask yourself, does this scale? What would we try differently? And so that's really what it comes down to. Growth, in my opinion, is synonymous with learning and having a high learning quotient mindset where you bring groups of people together who are excited about learning and growing. And yes, we're going to make a lot of mistakes. You know, you might, 7 out of 10 tests might fail. That's okay. You're learning and you're continuing to develop that program and process. That's what matters.
Yeah. The failure in those instances is almost as valuable as getting a clear yes. Like,
absolutely.
For me, it's the worst, like false positive, false negative, scary, but inconclusive results are where I find that marketers get themselves into real trouble. Like,
exactly.
Yeah.
Oh, you're so right. Yeah. Definitive answers is what we need. And, yeah. And that's what's so important. And if something's inconclusive, then you have to keep chipping away at it till you get the answers.
And it's so funny because I think that's another thing that you and I have in common where I just want to know. I was that kid that like was like, but why? But why? You know what I mean? Like, I just want to know the answer and I want to know why.
Exactly. Exactly. Because yeah. At the end of the day, like, that's what gets us satisfaction is knowing and having answers and having clarity. And, you know, that's another thing just about our work culture. And one thing I say that I personally strive for is like, cut the ambiguity. Let's be direct. Let's be honest. Let's just try to get to answers and not beat around the bush on certain questions and whatnot. Just in work culture, be direct, yeah. You know.
You don't want to do like a ton of like corporatisms and circle back and run around.
Yeah. Take things offline. Like, seriously.
Yes. God, oh, we love the parking lot. Remember the parking lot when you'd be in meeting? We're going to put this idea in the park. Yeah. I'm so sorry. Yeah, I should have given you a trigger warning.
Lot. Exactly. You know, at one point I'll admit that I brought that home to my everyday life where my friends and family were like, Mom, what do you just shut up? Because, you know, I was literally that guy.
We've all been there. It's we can, you know, I can laugh at myself a little bit.
First step is to acknowledge you have a problem.
You know what? If that just means that we've grown. And actually something you said made me think of like repeating experiments and like, we're not the same people that we were. Like, I'm not the same person that I was in 2020, even as a consumer, I'm kind of like continually adapting. And I think that's true of all humans, of all consumers. Like, we are, the only constant is change, right? So when you see consumer behavior adjusting so rapidly, and I think we're conscious of it also more in real time, but like, how do you stay agile and adapt your acquisition strategies, your channel mix, your, just because stuff comes up and fades so quickly now. So like, how do you stay agile in the face of all that change?
Yeah. So I think it comes back somewhat to the idea of product marketing in general and sticking to your principles and knowing your value propositions, your universal selling propositions, your value propositions, your features and benefits. And here's the kicker, right? Your product market fit may have worked, but with consumer behaviors, trends changing, all of a sudden you might be displaced. And now you're trying to scramble and figure out, how do I advertise this in some way different? It goes back to having that relationship with your product team, your engineering team. And the foundation is the go-to-market process. You constantly have to evolve and improve your products to be able to connect with your market and your audience. That's where marketing, product, and engineering are always integrated. And I believe it's a shared responsibility across all teams and all departments, but marketing has to be involved, has to be active to say, are we solving for the challenges and needs of the consumer that we're targeting today, or is something off? And so I think if you're scrambling and trying different channels and different tactics, that's not a good look for any business. That's not where you want to be. You can de-risk yourself by having a truly diverse acquisition mix, finding those audiences and speaking to the audiences in ways that feel native to them, whether it's offline or it's something digital. It's about having a diverse, healthy mix so you're not at a single point of failure.
Yeah. We have like this silly little game that we play called the A-B test. Cause you know, we're marketers. We love an A-B test. And it's a little bit work related, a little bit fun. Like every other conversation you've ever had with me, I can only be work related for so long of a time period before we go wildly off the rails. So we built something in to keep me roughly on guardrails. Okay. Work related first. Meta or Google?
Meta, because you're knocking on doors more than people are knocking on your door.
Oh, I like that. Dogs or cats?
Cats and dogs.
You can't. The answer to this one is really there's no right answer. It's like both because we don't deserve either as a people.
Pretty much.
Right?
Pretty much.
Like they're just the best.
Yeah, that's so true. I mean, it's we don't deserve them.
Nope. But we get them anyway.
Yeah. Wow. That's a tough one.
Right? I see. They're not. Listen, just like in marketing testing, sometimes there are variables and sometimes the answer is inconclusive. Okay. Feature-focused marketing or benefit-focused marketing?
Benefit. Because at the end of the day, you're either product-centric or consumer-centric. And I think you can have a product without a consumer.
Comedy or drama?
Comedy, because talking to friends and acting, it's harder. And I think you can be trained to do drama. I think comedy has to come naturally.
Yeah, there's a timing to it. Yeah. That's very, yeah, either you got it or you don't.
Totally.
Physical books or ebooks?
Oh, physical. You feel like you accomplished something when you can hold that in your hand. If it's all digital, it's the same as buying a Nintendo Switch video game. I'd rather get the cartridge than download it, just because tangible still holds value.
Oh, so still a hard media guy. Oh, I like that. Yeah. Subscription versus one-time purchase.
Depends, but that's not, sorry, again, AB, right? So
you must pick one or I will pause this interview. And what are we going to do?
So subscription when done right. Let's put it that way. Not subscription for the sake of subscription, but subscription when done right, meaning adds value, makes it easier so you can set it and forget it and trust that whatever that product is, it's working hard for you in the background.
Shopify or custom build?
Custom. Ooh. Well, custom for where I see things and where I've been. Don't get me wrong. Shopify is a beast. I love starting and building new businesses on Shopify, but all things created equal, you want to have as much control as you can. And custom, I think, can get you there with a lot of, it's way harder, but the rewards are greater.
That's fair. Morning person or night owl?
Is neither an option.
The answer is I don't want to be awake.
Pretty much. I mean, I was at a company for quite a while that was all about sleep. And now morning owl.
We'll go with that. I like it. That's like I can't. User generated or professionally produced content?
Professionally produced, artfully produced. You know, again, it comes back to control. UGC is wonderful. And it's the world we live in today. And you can't have business without it. But I think, again, there's something behind creating something and putting in the work.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that.
Yeah.
All right, last fun one. Supervillain or superhero?
I'm a big Darth Vader fan. And I think supervillains can find redemption in the day. And the hero's sort of journey or arc, there's always some antagonist. But I think, what's that saying? You sort of die a hero, you live long enough to become a villain.
Ooh.
So, yeah. I'll go against the grain there, you know. I think I think there's redemption, but there's more drama.
They have better costumes.
Yeah. It's just
also you get a lair. Like I want a lair.
I mean, Batman has a lair too, but you know
that's true.
But that's
just because Batman's got more money than anything. Like Batman's just my favorite thing for Batman is like your superpower is being rich, dude. Like
right.
it is
kind of like, makes him the villain if you think about it, you know? He's, yeah.
That's true. You live long enough to become a villain.
Exactly.
One of the things that scares me is when a marketer's like, oh, 80% of our budget is spent on Meta or Google.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh man, that way lies some sort of pain, because regardless of the high that you're on, whenever you're like, oh, I know marketers that have scaled it to a few million dollars a month profitably, and it's great. But then eventually the pool is only so deep on self-serve platforms, right? One of the things that I admire is that you have been really successful in intentionally diversifying the paid acquisition strategy, even into like other digital channels like Reddit and Snapchat, also into offline channels like TV, streaming. We've done, you know, a bunch of work together in audio. What are the markers for you? What are the things that you look at when you're looking at an acquisition mix and you're like, okay, you're ready to go like beyond Facebook, beyond Google, like you're ready to diversify now?
Mm-hmm. So, you know, I say this from a direct to consumer approach. If our North Star of our objective in any business is to drive people to your direct website, your web shop, where you want to establish some emotional connectivity with your brand, not just go to any other source to buy whatever that product or service might be, then in that case, you care about, I mean, there's really two KPIs that I look to: your cost per visitor for that traffic that you're driving and your conversion rate. And to put it simply, I would work with teams to create some sort of XY axis bubble chart that helps me understand where my channels are today. What does that mix look like? Because in some cases, I'm willing to spend a lot more if I see that conversion rate is significant. In other cases, I might want to balance it out and find some sweet spot in the middle where it converts well and it doesn't cost an arm and a leg to drive that. So at the end of the day, you know, there's always going to be a financial component to these decisions and making sure we have enough runway to be able to do these tests. But in a perfect world, you're looking at those two KPIs in particular and making sure that you're testing channels thoroughly. I think a lot of people, a lot of brands fail to do this. There's misaligned expectations on how long it takes to learn. Let's put it that way. And you could work with the biggest podcast in the world and try to get an answer in a few weeks, or you could try to diversify over several months, try different categories, strategies, tactics, hooks, and potentially learn what works for your business, or at least come on the other side of it saying, we put in everything we got and we know this works a certain way for our business. So I guess my point I'm trying to make here is part of it's a financial decision. Part of it is having strong foundations of measurement. Measurement is not perfect science. That's a whole can of worms, but just being grounded and being able to place multiple bets, not just a few.
Yeah. And to the point, when you're thinking about like which channel is the next right channel, is it some sort of like a sliding scale measurement in your head when you're looking at all these different KPIs of like, okay, I need to drive cost per visit down, or I need to, you know, work on whatever other tenet that you're trying to work on in the program? Is that like what dictates the next channel that you're testing? Is it some composite or some amalgam of all these KPIs and OKRs and all the acronyms marketers love?
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, I love that you gave a shout out to OKRs. I'm obsessed with that. But yeah, you know, most businesses will have at least one big OKR, which basically says sell a lot of shit, right? Whatever that might be, that's usually what it is. And so whatever KRs you have that ladder up to that team-wide or company-wide OKR, you know, it'll usually be, yeah, like I said earlier, there's a financial component to it. But I'd say if there's one more dimension I'd add to this, it's understanding your consumer journey in terms of time to convert. And there's so much out there that I think most businesses are unaware of. And I really believe we're at a point right now where I've read articles about this. The funnel as we know it is broken, and there is no awareness, consideration, conversion. It's all just consideration right now across every channel. People are might be at different stages of learning about your business, but the order in which they consume that content is not something a brand can ever control. They're just going to find out about it when they find out about it. And so I think what drives that decision-making for where we choose to invest, where we want to be present, you know, as marketers, it comes down to our bandwidth and our runway and what we think we're capable of testing within a certain annual budget. And it comes down to being able to, again, make informed bets. So,
yeah, I mean, that's what really the informed bets piece is. There's so much about what we do that is intuition driven. It's always a combination of intuition and data, right? It's different proportions of it. And you mentioned measurement's a whole other can of worms, and sometimes the data are wrong and pointing you in a different direction, and you have to kind of understand that.
It's nice to have multiple patterns. Exactly. You know, it's good to like look at patterns, and you can have, there are really great multi-touch attribution systems out there that I think are getting more and more traction. You have post-purchase survey data, you have in-channel data. You always have to triangulate, follow the patterns. And at the end of the day, no matter what model you have or forecast you have, every model has assumptions based on it and some guess. It just has to be well informed by what you've seen in the past. And it's something that you have to constantly monitor. And yeah, as marketers, like I said, just bringing it all back where we're learning along the way. Yes, we have targets we have to hit. There's goals we have to achieve. But I think what we can do is try to set a culture in which we can place more bets. And if we place more bets, we'll hopefully get some more wins.
Yeah. And it's funny because I feel like earlier in my career, I remember one time putting together a measurement deck and presenting the data and you know, my conclusions and whatever. And one of the account people I worked with was like, can you just make it sound a little more positive? And I'm like, the test failed. I don't know. How do you, like, we got a negative result. Like, what would you like me to do in that instance? The instinct, of course, is to like put a rose on everything. But it's like sometimes the things you find out, you're like, oh shit, like we messed up, Aaron. Like,
it's like, there's shit, Sherlock. Seriously. I think that's something that we all have to think about and reframe as a work culture is, how do you get people excited about learning where the failures are just as meaningful as the wins? Yeah, sure. It's a great high, sugar high to have A/B test succeed on your site and you can drive conversion rate by quarter, you know, percent, whatever it might be. Look, the balance is being able to not, you know, have so many fails in a test that you've created risk on the business. It's to be able to run in a testing environment where you have room to play around and be a bit of a mad scientist and test within reason. So let's not put everything, all our cards on the table all at once. Let's segment this, you know?
Yeah. And it's the iterative testing piece is so important for me. And that's framework that I took to offline marketing really early because I was just like, one of the interesting things for me about deciding to focus on offline marketing personally is like, there were so many tenets from digital marketing and growth marketing in particular that are not always applied to offline channels. And it's like, no, they can stand the scrutiny of those frameworks, right? There is something to the growth marketer's mindset of, I want to test exactly as much as I need to, no more, but no less, in order to get some meaningful results that I can use to then iteratively scale this program in the directions that I need to take it. And it's more challenging to create that framework in some channels, but I think that independent of channel, aren't you kind of always looking for a path to iteratively test, to learn, to then make the next $100,000 after the first $100,000perform twice as good, or, you know, whatever meaningful, increase we're looking for, right? No pressure.
Yeah, no, seriously. Like, that is something that we're always, you know, working towards, is what's that next echelon look like? And I think in the last several years, at least, I've seen many businesses say, let's figure out Facebook, let's figure out Instagram, let's figure out search. And then we're going to figure out how to expand higher up in the funnel to go to TV, radio, podcasts, digital out of home, et cetera. And I think there's less and less need for that gating as companies start to scale up. I don't think there's a solid point in time where you say, we've now earned the right to do and expand and start building out these other channels. I think going back to earlier in our conversation, whatever product you might have, you find product market fit on one channel, you master that, you make it reliable, you start spinning that flywheel. And then you look to your team and see, what did we learn with this channel that we can now translate or apply? Or what do we know already to be true about how people respond to our product? How do we now move that over to this whole new beast that we haven't tried before? And I think part of that's dictated by your runway, working with your finance team, making sure that you've earned the right to start testing something new. And that's an agreement that you have to have with your internal team and your leadership and your finance folks. But ultimately, I don't think there's any sort of stage gating here to go to those channels. I think there are many businesses that have proven over the last couple of years that they could start in offline before they go to a big play on digital and vice versa. And so, yeah, ultimately, all I'll say is that the one thing that does gate it is figure out reliable channels before you start spending time and investing in something you haven't done before, whichever direction that may be going. But have something reliable in place and earn that right to think about channel expansion.
Yeah. And there's always tension and interplay between demand capturing and demand generating channels. Mm-hmm. And I like the concept of not gating them. There are instances where, I mean, look, I'm the first person to tell somebody if they are not ready for radio or broadcast or anything like that. Like, there's just some times where you're like, oh, you haven't like fully broken your website and rebuilt it yet. Don't do linear television. Like, that's not the path that you want to find out that some critical part of your funnel is broken, right? But there's the demand generating channels feed into the demand capturing channels. Mm-hmm. And there's an interplay between them both. Because if you don't have, let's just say that the channel, the star channel in your mix is going to wind up being Google, both for prospecting and capturing, right? Like, it happens to be a category where search is really important. You know, it's a higher ticket item. Consumers are doing more research, whatever the case might be. But adding a demand generating channel earlier to that mix could actually change the fortunes of that demand capturing channel.
Oh, absolutely. And there's testing and trust involved in setting up that environment. If you truly have a great product and marketing's job is just to educate and inform the consumer that, hey, this exists and this can change your life for the better, whatever it might be, there is this trust that you put out there with certain channels to generate that demand that hopefully they will now start that journey. They'll be on that process. And whatever those micro moments might be that remind them of your product, that'll bring them back to your site. They'll have them take a second look. And so, yeah, I mean, it's insane to measure that, but I think it's crazy for someone to not play in that territory and just assume that demand capture alone is going to help them grow the business, because they're not feeding that funnel.
Well, that goes to the whole blue ocean thing of like, especially if you're creating a new category or if you're carving out a niche in a very competitive category, it's like, I hope you have something unique to say. And that makes it easier to sell the product. It's very funny because I've felt a lot of pressure to go towards sales in my career. People are like, you're so good at selling. I'm like, no. The only reason I'm good at selling anything is because I believe in it. If I don't believe in it, I don't have that bullshit gene in me to just be like, this is so great. Like, people are like, you speak with right side up about so much passion. I'm like, yeah, it's because I've been here for a really long time and I believe in the company and its mission and what we're doing and the people and all of that. But if I didn't, I'd be like, yeah, it's like, it's fine. Same goes for marketing a good product.
Exactly. Exactly. You never want to be timid about it. You want to be so passionate about it that this is clearly, you know, the best product, the best service that you can put out there, and you stand behind it as a marketer, because at the end of the day, you're the front lines. You may have not created the product, but this is your baby. This is something that, you know, you want to make sure that your rubber stamp, your, I talked about this with my team all the time, you know, your identity in some ways is attached to the work you put out there, whether you're an advertiser or a creative strategist or a brand marketer, what have you. And so you want to have skin in the game. And, you know, Tyler, CEO at BrightSetUp, once shared this with me. I'm going to paraphrase it, but if you talk to someone in a VC backed company and you want to make sure that they're working hard and putting everything they got, first thing is ask them, do you have equity? They respond and they're like, yeah, I've got some equity. Do you want them to be, do you want that to be worth something someday? You know, is the next question. And it, hopefully that answer is a resounding hell yes, because,
yeah.
And that's where the passion comes in. It's not just, I don't mean to say this from like a, hey, we're all financially motivated people. But I guess the point I'm trying to make, I think the point that Tyler was trying to make is that we all have skin in the game, you know, when it comes to our marketing and the work we put out there.
Yeah.
And so with that, our success is intertwined with our team members and just making sure that the work we do together matters and makes a difference and isn't just a moot point, right? You know? So yeah, I appreciate that mindset.
Yeah. It's 'cause also like, you work harder when you have pride in your work. Like I spent a lot of my early career trying to make people give more of a shit. The spoiler alert, that just frustrates everybody around you and yourself. So it's you need to care to a healthy extent, right? I love your point about making sure everybody at the company is redundant, because people don't do great work when they're burnt out. People don't do great work when it goes to the other extent, but they also don't do great work when they don't care. And just the idea, and on the flip side, there's another thing Tyler has said, and there's like a little, I don't want to say like a speech because that sounds contrived. It's not. Tyler has often said there's no such thing as a marketing emergency.
Yeah.
And I love that. I've told people nobody is going to like die because of a decision that you made in marketing. Like it's okay.
Pretty much. And yeah, I really appreciate that, because a similar analogy I've used is that for the most part, dates, deadlines, taking things to market, it's malleable. It's not ever set in stone. No one carved it in a stone and said, it must launch on this day with this spec to this requirement. And so, it's a healthier reminder that, for most things, we can set our own destiny. We don't have to launch it by this day because someone said so. At the end of the day, we should be able to do things. And I mean that at every level of a company. Do work with good intention. Put work out there that you feel proud about. And if something's not ready, just say it's not ready. And I'm not trying to like call out specific situations exactly. It's more of a broad term here that, yeah, we control our own destiny to a large degree, and we just have to communicate, and nothing's an emergency to that point. It's never an emergency.
Yeah. I mean, there's stuff that's urgent, right? I am a very big fan of the Eisenhower matrix when it comes to sorting out your to-do list and what you're trying to accomplish. And anytime anybody I work with struggles with prioritization, I bring that thing out, and everybody, you could just see the eye rolls occasionally, but I'm like, listen, shit works. Okay. He had a couple of more important decisions than we do, like just throwing it out there, but the shit works. But it's, urgency is a relative term, right? And yeah. And you can treat your work with urgency. That's of course, like that's good, but don't,
for sure.
Yeah. Urgency can translate into emergency if you're not careful.
Absolutely. And it's good to have that healthy culture where you just set the tone and help empower and enable your team, your colleagues, the folks who surround you to never get to that place where it doesn't become fun. You want people to, and I'm not trying to like say that in a very cheesy, like, hey, we're all in this together kind of crap. Like the one thing I hate, and I'll be honest, when someone says that, you're all one big family. No, we're here together for a certain amount of time. And hopefully for a long time. And the thing is, you want to look back 5 years, 10 years out, and just imagine that you're meeting with that same group of people again, and you can look back and laugh over things and just, look at how the world's changed and think about your work in that lens, that we're all in this spaceship together, you know, going around the sun, and we've got a couple of cycles together, and you just want to be happy and make sure that you care about your team and people as human beings as much as you care about the work that you put out in the world.
I love that. And that's, yeah, there's a fake way that some companies and try to like shortcut to that ethos. And it's not like, listen, yeah, all of the unlimited free snacks that you want in the world, all of the flexible schedules and unlimited PTO that nobody takes, et cetera.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's empathetic leadership. It's putting yourself in someone else's shoes and, you know, colleague, a friend, anyone on your team, and being able to say that you don't know what's going on in someone's life outside of their day to day, right? And you might not ever know. So it's important to just avoid judgments and just assume good intents from team members. And like I said, it's all, everything we do is temporary, whether it's a few years or a lot of years. And you just have to make sure that showing up to work, being able to put in the work and be able to set up an environment where people are able to be passionate about things and work with really good intent.
I love that. And I, you know, it's funny, we always ask a question at the end of our interviews. We hear the term growth hack all the time. And sometimes there's like the sentiment that growth marketing can be reduced to like a bunch of growth hacks just strung together and poof, you have a company and you made money and yay. Yeah. What I want to know is like, what's your favorite growth non-hack?
Yeah. Well, I think it kind of goes into our conversation a little bit, but it's about setting the culture for a growth team to have a foundation. And, you know, we talked about learning earlier on this call and having processes in place to document and to share that learning at scale. But when it comes down to the culture, it's setting up an environment where people are able to volunteer ideas, to bring ideas to the table, to question ideas that might be out there, to be a devil's advocate and to say to anyone in any level of authority, hey, I hear you, but what if we tried it this way instead? What if we gave it a chance? It's being able to speak up and not worry about being judged or being looked at or being critiqued because you were able to step in when you felt like you had that light bulb moment, that moment to shine to come in. And if it lands well, awesome. And if it doesn't land well, there's nothing lost at all. You still feel reassured that you've got that level of support. So I think that's an intangible. It's to me, the non-hack is set a strong culture and give people that environment where they can truly learn, truly adapt, and ultimately set something up that's sustainable.
I can't think of a better way to end. Thank you so much for the time and for your honesty and openness and vulnerability and all of the things that we talked about here. I think it's so clear to me why your teams love working with you, and I'm grateful for you. So thank you very, very much for the time
I
spent.
I appreciate it. This was so much fun. It's always a pleasure to catch up and chat and, you know, mix work and life together and on a call like this. And so, no, I really appreciate it. And this was a ton of fun.
Thanks for joining us on this episode of Growth Talks. We hope you found our discussion insightful and fun. Don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to our channel for more valuable content. And if you're excited and ready to start up-leveling your growth strategies and execution, RightSideUp has you covered. RightSideUp is a leading growth marketing agency that has partnered with over 1,000 companies of all stages and sizes to help them meet and exceed their growth goals. With expertise across all growth marketing functions, we can help you evaluate product market fit, develop customer acquisition strategies, navigate executional challenges and staffing gaps, and make pivotal decisions with confidence. And whether you need one individual or a custom-built, full-service team, we'll find you the right A-plus talent. Visit us at rightsideup.com to see how we can help you and your company grow.